Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and thanks for coming out on this bitter cold night. I know you'll be glad that you did. We are honored tonight to have David Robleski back at the Tattered Cover with his book, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, that is now out in paperback. He returns to his home in Colorado after his international tour this fall to book festivals in Rio de Janeiro and three cities in Germany. His readers everywhere are fascinated with this literary novel of wonderfully complex characters and their dogs that once you start to read it, you absolutely cannot put it down. Please help me welcome David Robleski.
Hi, everyone. And I just want to second the thanks for coming out on a night like this. This is now that we're here, though, we don't want to go back outside, I'm sure. At least that's my feeling. I thought what I'd do. First of all, I just want to say I've been lucky to begin the hardcover tour of this book. Last June it was here at the Tattered Cover, actually in the Colfax store. And this is the last stop on the paperback tour. So I have started and ended by doing readings at the best bookstore in America. No kidding. It really is. No joke. I've spent on the order of 18 months visiting bookstores, and this is still my favorite. So it's a real honor to be here again. I thought what I would do tonight is read a short section from the middle of the book, talk a little bit about a couple of other books. I brought a bunch of books with me I wanted to tell you about that went into the research behind this book. And then I thought I would open it up for Q&A and we could just talk. So what's going on in this passage? I assume that by now everyone knows the basic groundwork for the story, which is that Edgar is a mute. The time is 1972 or so. Edgar is a boy who's mute but not deaf, and his family raises a fictional breed of dogs. And there's a lot of conflict and drama. That's the best I can do with summarizing the book. I used to say, by the way, that this is a boy and his dog story for grown-ups, and that was my one-line description of the book. But now I've stopped saying that, and I say it's a case of backwoods science fiction, which is confusing, and I like them both for that reason, because they don't actually tell you anything. In the passage I'm going to read now, it happens about 40% of the way through the book. And it's kind of a mood piece. Most of the story is told over the course of a summer, and then a winter, and then the following summer. And it is now the beginning of that following summer. There's been a death in the family for which Edgar feels at least partly responsible. And the night before this passage, he has been out in the rain. And in an unusual way has discovered information that changes much of what he thought was true about the situation in his family. And in particular, that the loss that has happened in his family was simply fate. And what happens here suggests, I think, his change in perspective. You're going to hear references to two of the dogs that Edgar is responsible for, Essay and Tinder, who are now yearlings. And they are part of a litter of seven pups that have been given to him to raise, as well as a passing reference to a dog named Almandine, who's been Edgar's inseparable companion since from birth. And in this passage, you also get a quick tour of the main stage setting for this story, which is this farm, and particularly this barn of gigantic proportions, which is practically a character of its own in the book, and was converted to a kennel from a dairy barn long ago by Edgar's grandfather. The previous scene here ends with Edgar standing in the rain in front of that barn, and the name of this chapter is Awakening. He came up out of a darkness that was not sleep, but something vaster and more comforting. The black of willful unconsciousness, or perhaps the night that precedes the first awakening, which babies know in the womb and forget ever after. There was Essay's breath panting slow and hot against his face. When he cracked an eyelid, her jet-whiskered muzzle and curious eye filled his vision. And he pushed her away and curled his head to his knees and squeezed his eyelids shut. Even so, he'd glimpsed enough to know he lay inside the run farthest from the doors and nearest the whelping room, and that the bare lights blazed along the kennel aisle. Outside, rain fell, roaring, a torrent against the roof. There was the rustle of canvas flaps, and another dog trotted up, this time Tinder, who dug his muzzle into the crevice between Edgar's chin and chest, and snuffled and drew back and cocked his head with a low, puzzled groan. Bits of straw began to itch along his neck. His shirt clung to his ribs, gelid and damp. A spasm shook his body, then another, and he gasped, and despite himself, drew a full breath that carried into him the odors of the kennel. Sweat and urine, straw and turpentine, blood and defecation, and birth and life and death. All of it alien and bitter, as if the whole history of the place itself had suddenly blossomed in his chest. And with it, masked until the last instant, the memory of what had happened in the night. Then Essay and Tinder accosted him together. He could summon only the strength to sit cross-legged against the wooden wall and bury his face in his arms, counting by sound the dogs shuffling through the straw in their pens as rain thundered onto the barn. When he lifted his head again, Essay and Tinder stammered before him and snaked their necks against his palms and shimmied. In time, he pushed himself upright. Patches of wet cloth sucked away from his skin. He slipped out of the pen and walked to the Dutch doors and stood with one hand on the latch, listening to water sheeting off the eaves. He drew a breath and swung the door outward. The sapphire sky above floated a small, lone cloud made orange by the sunrise. The new leaves on the maple stirred and quaked. Sparrows cartwheeled over the wet field like glazier's points against the sky, and the swallows nesting in the eaves plunged into the morning air. The house burned white against the green of the woods, the Impala neon blue. But there was no torrent to be seen, not even a drizzle. The sound of falling rain possessed him for one moment more and then vanished. He was past the milk house before he remembered the syringe and turned and found it crushed in the center of a grassy puddle, needle snapped, barrel broken in a wash. He cupped it in his palm and carried the pieces to the old silo, where he pitched them through the rusted iron rungs and listened as they struck the far curve of cement and stone with a papery ring. Then he walked up the driveway, faster as he passed the house, the orchard, the mailbox. He started up the road, wheeled, and headed the other way, breaking into a run and then dropping into a jerky, reined-up step. He turned again. After a time, he found himself walking back down the driveway, and he began to circle the house in that same halting stride. 5 times around, 10, 20 times, looking into the darkness behind the window glass. Each time he passed the old apple tree, its lowest branches tugged at him and brushed him, and he brushed them away until he finally came to rest, panting, caught for the umpteenth time, and at last he turned to look at it. It was an old tree, old already when he was born, maybe older than the house itself. At eye level, the trunk split into three thick and nearly horizontal limbs, the longest of which arced toward the house and ended suddenly in a mass of waxy leaves. The branch would have continued through the kitchen window had it not been pruned mid-limb. He was shaking and chilled, and his fingers were stiff, but he managed to boost himself into the crotch of the tree, and from there he worked himself onto the limb. The bark felt greasy from long days of rain. Past halfway, the branch began to buck and wobble under his weight. Rainwater, cupped in the new foliage, showered him every time he moved. He worked slowly along. When he got to the stump end, he steadied himself by gripping a horn-like pair of limbs and settled his sternum against the branch and lay outstretched, a swimmer among the boughs. The window over the sink was closed, the gingham curtains parted to either side. The thin morning light was not enough to illuminate the interior, and at first only the orange power light at the base of the freezer was visible, its bulb winking and flickering. His breaths made the limb tremble like the string of an instrument wound over tight. It was no wider than his hand, and its bark bit into his chest, and soon his chest began to ache from it. He did not know why he was in the apple tree or what he was looking for, but he lay waiting. In time, the side of the barn glowed red. One of the kennel dogs pressed into its run and looked around and retreated. The morning air was bright and water-laden. From downfield, a killdeer chattered, "Kitty, kitty." Almondine floated into the kitchen, padding along on old legs. She paused beside the stove and circled the table and disappeared. Then Edgar's mother walked into view, robe cinched around her waist. She stood with her back to the window and started the Mr. Coffee. She lifted her hair in a rope and dropped it outside her robe and waited. She filled her cup. She liked coffee black with just a bit of sugar. He'd made it for her many times that winter. And he watched her lift the spoon from her cup and put it wet into the sugar bowl twice and sip the coffee. The corner of the kitchen was windowed on two sides. She stood in profile, looking west at the vapor writhing over the field. When Claude appeared, he was dressed, as if he had just arrived. He walked up behind her and put one hand on her shoulder and let it rest there. He smoothed the collar of her robe against her neck and walked to the sink and rinsed out a cup. He didn't look out then, just turned and poured his coffee and sat in the chair nearest the sink. Their murmur penetrated the window glass, but not their words. After a few minutes, Edgar's mother set her cup on the table and walked to the bathroom. Claude sat watching the Mercator of sunlight advance up the field. Wisps of fog swirled and thinned under the new heat of morning. A flock of sparrows lit at the bird feeder at the corner of the house, bickering and flapping one another out of the way, so close Edgar could have snatched one. Edgar lay in the tree and watched. Claude was leaner than his father, and though he was younger and without his father's bookish stoop, his hair was shot with gray. He sat in Edgar's father's chair and pursed his lips and brought the coffee cup to his mouth. Edgar had been afraid he would see them kiss. Almandine went up to Claude and raised her face, and Claude smoothed his hand over the top of her skull. Edgar's mother emerged from the bathroom, hair turbaned. Incandescent light from the bedroom fell across the kitchen table. Claude stood and went to the sink and rinsed out his coffee cup. And finally, he looked out that window. Maybe he didn't know what he'd seen at first. His gaze passed aimlessly across the tree and moved on. Edgar had time to wonder if the new leaves were camouflage enough to hide him, though it didn't seem possible, and he didn't care anyway. Claude swabbed the dishcloth in his cup and picked up a towel and began to dry it. But somewhere in the back of his mind, there must have been a twinge, a nag, an afterimage. For when he lifted his face again, he looked straight at Edgar. And then he shuddered and stepped back from the sink. A step back. A small motion, perfectly natural, if any reaction can be said to be natural, when you realize someone has climbed a tree outside the window and has been watching like a panther for God knows how long. Since you woke up, perhaps. You lean forward. The boy's hair is wet and dripping, as if he has been there all night in the rain. He has a frozen, impudent look on his face, as if the pane of glass between you could protect him from anything, from everything. And if he blinks, you do not see it. After a long stare, to be sure you are seeing what you see, you understand that the boy has been up there all along. The rustle wouldn't have escaped your attention even if you had been half asleep and distracted. And the birds would never have battled like they did over the feeder just an arm's length away. You weigh the idea that this is a prank. You lean back and try to quietly laugh as if you are in on it. You turn your back and set the coffee mug down on the table and then look out the window again and watch with false equanimity as the boy peers back, hands clasped around the bough he is balanced so far out upon. And when his mother comes up behind you, you turn and face her, and that is when you kiss. You unselfconsciously kiss. Her hand lingers on your shoulder. You stand with your back to the window, saying nothing about what you have seen as she pulls her coat off its hook. She says one last thing, and then she and Almandine are out the door and walking toward the barn. You turn back to the window. Though you expect him to have looked away to gaze at his mother and the dog as they cross the yard, he has not. His expression is slack, and his eyes fill his face. He is all watching, no reacting. And a small voice in the back of your mind says, "This is a boy that spends his days watching. You are not going to win a staring contest." And you get to thinking as well, he is still staring from his wet perch, that if this is a contest, then you have already lost. Because in that moment when you first understood what you were seeing through the window, when your eyes said it was so and your mind replied it was impossible, in that moment, as you think of it from the boy's viewpoint, you know you looked frightened. You stepped back from the window. Back from the sight of his foreshortened body, fronted by that face, those eyes, that shock of hair hanging over his forehead, dripping. You stepped back and looked up, and your eyes were wide. Now you glance up again, attempt an insolent grin, but it does not come off easily. It comes off forced. And the grin fades as if the muscles of your face have grown paralytic. And this is also something the boy can see, who has not once looked away or betrayed any emotion. But your failure to muster a smile isn't what gets to you. What gets to you is that the boy seems to be reading your mind, can hear these thoughts, and this makes you wonder what else he has seen, what else he might know or guess. And as you lock gazes, and you finally force the amused smile you wish had come easily, what unnerves you, what finally makes you turn away, is that without moving a muscle or blinking an eye, he begins to smile back. I'm sorry about my voice. I was running from airport to airport for the last 3 months, expecting any day to come down with the swine flu or some version of it, and it didn't catch up to me until about 2 days ago. So, I thought before we started just talking, I'd tell you about a couple of books. And the first one I brought with me, it's the first time I've ever been able to bring this book with me, so I want to start with that. For those of you who've already read the book, you know that Edgar has a dictionary that he loves. It's called the New Webster Encyclopedic Dictionary of the English Language, including a dictionary of synonyms and 12 supplementary, the words are actually rubbed off, so I can't tell. 12 supplementary sections, reference sections. And this is that book. And all the dogs, he names the dogs by picking words out of this dictionary. And all the words and the definitions that are listed in the book are from this old dictionary. So I thought I can't take it with me on the road, but since I live here, I thought I would bring it. And this is it's a hilarious dictionary. Dictionaries can be funny, and this one is very funny because it took its charter seriously to be an encyclopedic dictionary. So the first half of it or so is actually a dictionary, or the first two-thirds. And then there's this reference section at the back that has things like popular quotations, classical mythology, something called a manual of information, a secretarial guide, a section on business law. There's a whole essay on naming, how to name your children. There's a history of the United States. There's flags of the nations, and there's all the presidents of the United States. And it ends with the constellations. So it sort of starts small and then gets bigger and bigger until it covers the entire universe. And if you go to the website for Edgar Sawtelle, on the Tangents page, the banner image there has his dictionary with a leash laying over it. So anyway, I thought I would bring that tonight. Anybody who wants to take a look at it afterward can take a look. So that's one fun book. And I guess the reason why I like to talk about books around this book is because, first of all, Edgar feels to me like the kind of person who would really love, who really loves other books. One of the books that he loves is The Jungle Book, of course. But also because I get asked a lot about where this story comes from. And the real answer is that, stories come from a couple of different places, but one place that stories come from are from other stories or from other books. So there are two other books that I would tell you about right now, and they're both histories of breeding programs, dog breeding programs that I ran across. And the first one is called, I have it here somewhere, it's called Working Dogs. When I found it back in the mid-90s, it was out of print, and you could find the text of it online. It's subsequently been put back into print by Dogwise, a small publisher. It was published in 1934 by Elliot Humphrey and Lucien Werner. And what they had done was in Vevey, Switzerland, established a breeding program called Fortunate Fields. And Fortunate Fields was funded by a wealthy philanthropist named Dorothy Eustace, who had a dog named Hans, a German Shepherd, who was incredibly helpful to her, and she thought dogs should be used to help people out more. And so she put her money into funding this breeding program on her farm, which was called Fortunate Fields. And I don't know how she discovered Humphrey and Warner, but they basically did the research. She supplied the money, and they did the research. And they started with 21 dogs after extensive pedigree research in Germany, picked out 21 German Shepherds, and began breeding them to do various kinds of service work, but most importantly, to be a guide dog for the blind. And the Fortunate Fields program ultimately turned into what we now call the Seeing Eye program. And it's based out of Morristown, New Jersey. So probably every one of us has seen the result of the Fortunate Fields work. And for those of you who've read the book, you know that Fortunate Fields gets mentioned. And what I did was I attached a third author to this book and then put all kinds of words in his mouth, which felt like the most respectful thing to do, as opposed to putting words into one of their mouths, is to just divide their credit for the book by one third. So one of the interesting things about the way they described this project, though, and which was inspiring to me, was there's a single sentence in here that I want to read to you. This is how they described the Fortunate Fields Project. The prime object of the Fortunate Fields Project is that of producing a strain of dogs which are peculiarly able to profit by instruction. And I read that, and I thought, what does that mean? but my imagination kind of ran away with me almost immediately. I had already begun work on this book, and I was looking for prototype breeding programs that were based on breeding dogs for behavior, not for their physical appearance. And this was the first one I ran into. And I thought it was a wonderfully evocative way of saying what their goals were. Because if you have a dog that is uniquely able to, or peculiarly able to, profit by instruction, then it could do many things. But it would have implications for how you would raise them and what your responsibilities would be if you owned one. So that's one book I would talk about. And the other is another breeding program called, well, I didn't have a name. It was a research project out of Bar Harbor, Maine. That was done in the 50s. And the results were published in a book called Genetics and the Social Behavior of the Dog by Scott and Fuller. And what Scott and Fuller did, this was a research project that went on for about 15 years. The objective was to try and understand the question of nature versus nurture in dogs. Are dogs born as a blank slate? Or do they really inherit certain behaviors? We always talk about certain breeds of dogs being like this or like that. And they wanted to know whether that was really true. And if it was true, would it be possible to breed dogs in such a way that you could select for certain kinds of innate behavior? And back then, the question of nature versus nurture, it was legitimate to state it as a sort of dichotomy, an either or. We, of course, now know that it's not nature versus nurture, it's nature and nurture, and that nature and nurture interact in very complex ways, even in the womb. Just the sort of the chemical environment can change how an embryo develops. And of course, anybody who's done any work with dogs or had a litter of pups knows that just any litter of pups is a experiment in itself in nature versus nurture, because they're all born at the same time. They all have the same mom, the same dad, but they end up having very different behaviors, even though they have exactly the same environment around them. So the people who ran this study, and this was, by the way, this was run in Bar Harbor, Maine, described it as a school for dogs. And the idea was to take dogs of various different breeds and make them, put them in a essentially in a problem-solving situation, and let the best in the class have a litter with the other best in the class, and to see what would happen. And there are fabulous pictures in here. What I love about this book is there are fabulous pictures in here of, and I'll leave it up here so you can see afterward, of scientists in white lab coats, unironically in white lab coats, standing and manipulating mazes and so on with pulleys and so on to test the dogs and having them go up ramps and so on. Again, these pictures are very evocative, or was to me. And so the Sawtelle breeding program was based on some imaginative concoction of these two breeding programs. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming. And I will leave these books up here for you to take a look at.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.